Okay, we're good. I want to start in a particular place today. And we are going to be, this is where we're going, monitoring your heart, so to speak. We're going to be talking a little bit about aligning with appropriate action. We'll look at the frictions to aligning with appropriate action. We'll see how action is naturally called forth, and maybe if there's an opportunity for a demo, and then calling forth actions in your lives. But one of the things that I wanted to start with is this check-in, and then I'm going to go to just pull some information out of an article that I read this week. It's been around the block on the internet, but it came back around, so I thought it was appropriate. So these are the questions. What's become clear for you about how you're being or what you're doing with respect to what's important in your life? What's become clear for you? What's still foggy? And what is clarity telling you to do more of, less of, or not do at all anymore? So any one of those three questions is the prompt for our opening conversation.
So, Michael, let me take some of this on.
Okay.
It's sort of my what's clear for me or my experience of everything so far. So what I'm experiencing is that somehow I have allowed space so that all of this learning, which is somewhat new, but seemingly not at all, is sort of naturally coming in like it was always there.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm able to experience more the beingness rather than just the intellectualization, much more than I thought I would. And it's really not as overwhelming as I thought it would be.
Wonderful. And that follows, as I mentioned, something a while ago, which is Socrates' principle of anamnesis, which is that we come into the world with all the wisdom we truly need, and upon the advent of birth, we tend, in the trauma of it, we tend to forget everything, and then we spend the rest of our lives relearning it. Which speaks to what you mentioned about, like, it's new and not so. You know, there's a familiarity with it. When it finally gets plugged into the being, we go, oh, yes, of course, like it's been there all the time. Because it actually has been.
Well, I would intellectually sort of take that on, being that we're I don't know whether we forget it. But I think what it is we're not connected to it.
Yes.
And we get reconnected to the field of consciousness where all this stuff resides.
Yes, and I would shift the language just a little bit on that, is that we are always connected to it, but we're not connected to our experience of it.
Perfect. Nice. Yep.
You know, because there's nobody on this call or anywhere on the planet who can't be connected with the universe. In order for you to do so, you'd have to be outside it, which would be a little odd to consider at the very least. You know, in religious terms, that would be someone who says that I'm disconnected from God. No, well, no, you're not. If God is all, in terms of that parlance and language, if God is all, then you can't be disconnected from God. You can be disconnected from your experience of it, of the oneness of everything, but you can't be disconnected from the oneness because you're part of the oneness no matter what. So, very cool. But what's really nice to hear is that it has shifted from conceptual and doesn't sound like it even hung there very long. You know, down into the beingness of you. Who else? What of these three questions is hanging out for you?
Well, I'll go. So what's clearer and what keeps coming up is to be in the present moment. So I had I'm teaching an online class, and I had a bumpy class last week, And, you know, and it was kind of hanging in there, like, what does it mean? What does it mean about me? And this is all that stuff. And and then I had a class yesterday, the same group, and it was just, and I just, so some question came to me like 2 minutes before the class started that felt like, oh, this would be a really good question to ask. And being in the present moment with that class, it was just all different. I mean, and they, you know, and they commented on how different it was too. And so that place of letting go of what was yesterday or last week or whatever, and being mm-hmm. now keeps coming back for me. It's so important. And so that's my practice. It's really supporting me to just keep being in the right this moment. What's happening? What am I noticing? And experiencing that connection to the universe and doing what I can, I guess, to let go of the pictures so I can be that open mm-hmm. space to allow it to come through me
right.
really supports me.
Well, it's brilliant. It's that simple, and not necessarily that easy, but it is that simple, and it's brilliant to stay there because what you can do at this moment can change how that class was delivered, the previous one.
Right. Yeah. Not too much.
Yeah. It's gone.
Yeah.
It's gone. You know, like yesterday's dinner. It's gone. Okay? Now, there may be some ripple effects, but nevertheless, there is nothing. And this is why focus on the past only as a kind of curiosity to see whether or not something is revealed. But for the most part, focus on the past doesn't carry much value simply because we cannot change it. We can change our relationship to it. And by that, I mean we can change our memory and how we're relating to the effects of what we think happened in the past. But knowing that the past is really a memory and a memory is subject to interpretation of selective interpretation at best. I don't spend much time in the past or looking at it. Now, it doesn't mean I may not reference pieces of it, but I don't, and I especially don't pull out assessments of myself in the past. And I'll tell you why. Because over the course of my life, I'm in a movie. I'm not in a frame. I'm not in a snapshot. As a human being, I'm an ever-evolving being, which means in this moment in time, I'm not even the same guy as I was yesterday. So to, in any way, shape, and form, at this moment in time, assess or weigh or judge myself for who I was yesterday takes me into attempting to live in the past and then trying to make some sort of correction about who and how I was. And I can't. I can't do squat about it. And I might think that, well, by doing that, I can avoid doing some of that stuff in the future, but that may... What I'm doing when I do that is that I'm skipping over the present human being of now. I may not be recognizing who I am now. So I'm busy trying to manage the future out of a past self when I'm already past the past self. And by staying present, what I can do is I can feel and sense into what's calling to have action taken on it today, now, in this moment. Because any energy I attempt to put on trying to change the past is futile. It's like dividing your computer's drive and RAM into like, 50% is going to be on the past. And it's going to run in a loop program because there's not going to be anything that you can do about it. Think of what's happened when you've deleted a file. Can you I mean, yes, I suppose you could try and dig it up. If you're really a masterful professional in the computer, you could. When you've deleted a file, it's gone. It's done. And our willingness to be done with the past is extraordinarily useful. Done with our perceptions of ourselves, done with our perceptions of others. And we think, well, geez, this person might be dangerous. This person's been dangerous in the past. And if I don't remember from the past, I might miss the fact that they're dangerous now, still. Now, what that's pointing to is that point, that person is, if they're dangerous now, the fact that they were dangerous in the past is irrelevant. They're dangerous now. So if we're more attuned to where we are now, and we can be more sensing about what it is that they are now, then we can be attuned to whether or not they're dangerous now. But we tend to hold on to stuff. And the image that I have of that all the time is Marley's ghost when he comes in to visit Scrooge. And there he is. And he says, what's that? And he says, I'm held by the chains and locks of the sins of my past. And of course he can't move on. Who can?
I don't think it's Marley. I think it's Molly.
Molly's ghost.
Uh-huh. And they say if the shoe fits, wear it. I wonder who you're talking to tonight.
I'm talking to me. I'm talking to all of us.
Yeah. And there's a big halo over me right now in the room.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I'll tell you, out of what BJ had mentioned about being in the now and about not being in the past webinar and the recognition that you can't change the webinar. You can't do it. Any webinars that I may, under someone else's estimation, have screwed up in my entire life, any relationships I may have screwed up in my entire life, I can't do anything about that now. I'm not a time traveler. Expending energy, and especially thought and emotional energy, in that direction is a misallocation of my resource. I've got plenty to do in the present.
Well, Michael, let me just ask something about that. If there's something in the recent past that you've screwed up, and by taking action in the now, you can in fact help the future of that, whatever it's a relationship or whatever it is, that's not going back in the past, but that is impacting the past because it's making the present different.
No, it's not impacting the past. It is impacting the present. And the action that you're mentioning, like an amends, the action that you're mentioning is something that's being called for in this moment, but it will still not change the event, the historic event of that other thing.
No, but the hope is it'll change the event in the minds of the participants moving forward.
It may not change the event in the minds of the participants moving forward, but it may change your relationship in the now with them out of the desire to, in making an amend, out of that desire, you're seeking a bridge in this moment in time, which means you're coming from a different place. And so that may have a shift in who they are. But you still can't, you know, if I shoot someone in the past, I can do everything I can to make amends to that person's family at this point in time, but it's still not going to change the fact that that person is dead. So now what we're dealing with is, what's the given now? The given now is, this family is upset. They're feeling XYZ about me. I can do certain things about them, but they're upset in the now. They're not upset in the past. They're upset in the now. So I'm interacting with the now state of being.
Well, there's no choice about that. That's all there is.
Yeah. So
there may be a learning in the now from what happened in the past, but it's still about the now.
Yeah, there's only a learning in the now if it occurs now.
Right.
You know, there's a cliche out there, something about, you know, unless we learn from the mistakes of our past, we're doomed to repeat them. Really? Who made that rule? Who says that we even have to go down that tunnel again? Because inherent in the phrase, unless we learn from our mistakes, is the notion that things didn't go the way they were supposed to go or should have gone. They went the way they went. Was it a mistake? I don't know. We could assign that meaning to it if we choose. I tend not to. I tend to include it as, you know what? That was a turn that took me here on the path, and then that took me to here, 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 and then that took me to here. Was that a mistake and I didn't walk straight on the path? No, it was just that took me here, that took me there, that took me there, took there, took me there.
Isn't it supposed to serve more as a point of reference?
Go a little further with what you're asking.
Like, you know, like you were saying, for example, this action takes you to a certain place.
Yes.
I think, are we not supposed to just keep it as a point of reference and not really allow it to hold the space of being what, you know, A plus B doesn't always have to equal C. It could be D or E or F, so to speak, but you know, you use as a point of reference, A plus B could equal C.
It could. However, what we have to do is, not what we have to do, but what is a potential very seductive trap,
uh-huh,
is for us to assign the interpretation to what occurred,
okay,
from our perspective at the time, as if that is actually what occurred. Because we're only seeing it from one frame of reference. So do we really know what occurred?
All you have to do is have a husband and wife experience, go through the same experience and talk about it, and you know that reality is through the eyes of the beholder.
Yes. There's a wonderful movie called Vantage Point. I think Dennis Quaid was in it or somebody like that. There's one, and Forrest Whitaker, and a number of other people, Vantage Point. I strongly recommend it because it gives a whole, you know, it presents certain scenes, and then you see the scene, then inevitably, as movies lead us to do, and we sometimes will leap to, it has us draw a conclusion. But then we get that same scene from someone else's vantage point, and now we go, oh, that's what was going on there. And then we get that same scene from yet a third vantage point, and now we have to readjust yet again. And it's a wonderful example of that, mm-hmm, vantage point. It was also a nice movie about, and it's one of the things, it wasn't an Asian movie, one of the things that I enjoy about a lot of Asian movies is that Asian movies tend to deal in gray rather than black and white. And what that means is that, you know, like many of their characters have good sides, and some of their good characters have bad sides, and you see them. So you see that no one is actually all or nothing of any of that. So that's where we're playing, is having the clarity of where we can really optimize our activity, our effects. Where do we want to allocate the resource called action? And usually we want to allocate it in a realm of aligning with the appropriate action as we sense and feel the future coming toward us. So this is aligning with appropriate action. This is this agility. And it's born of the law of least effort, which, as I've clarified before, doesn't mean no effort. It means least effort, much like water coming down a hill. It doesn't look to smash its way around the rock, into the rock or through the rock. It goes over the rock or around the rock. Doesn't mean it isn't wearing on the rock, but it's going, that's nature's way. Wind does the same thing. Aligned appropriate action is relatively, I would say, in almost all cases, friction-free. It has an optimal flow, and it's an absence of forcing. We're not trying to make it be a particular way. We're trying to attune to the moment, the situation, and the resources, which are both apparent and available, and then act with that. And sometimes appropriate action is not taking an action. So here are the three frictors, the primary ones, not that there aren't many, but these are the three categories of frictors. Avoidance. These are the ones that keep us from aligning. Running away from taking the action that's called for. Okay? So for some people, that might be taking particular actions with their health or with their bank account. You know, all of a sudden your budget, you know, one's budget is getting low or one's money is getting low, and one keeps spending as if one was still in there because, you know, we know that there's an action that we don't really want to take. Or we force, we try to make it happen when it's not optimal. And an example of that, trying to force things, is like being on a surfboard. Anybody surf on this call? Okay. Body surf? No. Okay. Well, it's like being on a surfboard in still water, and you paddle and paddle and paddle to get the feeling of surfing, and you're paddling really hard, but you can't really paddle fast enough to match what's available when a wave happens. You can't basically paddle fast enough or hard enough to create your own wave to stand up and ride on. But that would be trying to force something. Now, that doesn't mean, you know, that you won't have to paddle to catch a wave, but that's the appropriate action. You're aligning with the timing as well. So the wave is coming through, and you're aligning with the fact that the wave is coming through. So, yes, you may have to take some action to paddle, and you might have to paddle hard for a couple of minutes. And then the wave catches you, and you move forward. However, if you sit out there, you can also watch waves of action go underneath you time and time and time again. And if you're not far enough out in the surf, the wave will actually pick you up, throw you underwater, and do what they call Maytagging, which is you feel like you're in a washing machine and it's swirling you around and around underneath the water. So that's forcing. Now, aligning also has this element of accountability to it. And aligning is about, accountability is about being either unable or unwilling to be accountable or give one's word effectively. And I want to talk a little bit about the last part of it. Is to be able to give our word effectively, one of the things that we have to do is we have to not be hooked by whether or not somebody likes us. That doesn't mean I have this one down perfectly, but what I notice is that the less I give my word, the more powerful it is when I do. And equally importantly is that when I give my word, if I miss it, I do need to make up on it. But more importantly, it's going to be valuable for me to ask myself, what had me give my word at that moment in time? And was I completely clear about what was really truly being asked or required in that moment in order to complete on giving my word? So most of the time when you're working with clients and they're not being what one might call accountable, it's not that they have no intention of following through. It's more likely that they have given their word when it wasn't really a fit to. And because they've been conditioned to do that through most work environments, you know, your boss says, you know, I need this by Friday. Can you get it? Well, actually, they don't usually say, I need it by Friday. They say, can you get it done by Friday? In the guise of a question. But they're not asking whether or not you can get it done by Friday. They're saying, I need and want it by Friday. Now, because most people fear for their jobs, they don't go, no, I can't. And every now and again, you get somebody who has enough sense of self to say, given everything on my plate, which do you want me to push off my plate in order to get it done by Friday? Now, those are people who have a certain level of sense of personal security, and they can make that kind of response, but that's not a lot of people. In most work environments, saying no is not a good idea. And that's unfortunate because it means that people, the bosses, the managers, the leaders, aren't getting an absolute yes from their people. They're getting a conditional yes. They're getting a yes, I'm going to say yes so I don't get fired yes. Or yes, I'm going to say yes to get you off my back, yes. Or yes, I'm going to say yes because I'm afraid I'll upset you and you'll be pissed off at me. So they're not getting a fully considered and full body yes. So here's the accountability frictor. This is part of the elements of it. This is the kind of language. Some of these will be the kind of things that you hear. You made me do it when I didn't want to do it in the first place. If no is not an option, yes is not a choice. Lack of awareness. I didn't think it would take this much time. Excuses. The Facebook ate my homework. Justifications, explanations. I couldn't do it because. Till death do us part. If I say I'm going to do it, then I have to, even if I change my mind or I get new information. That's the other side of the accountability frictor. That's being overly accountable just because you said you would. When actually what is missing is the awareness of what it's really going to take. And you didn't have that awareness. Or clarity. So those can be subtracted. Here's the avoidance frictors have language like this. You know, people tend to not take action, align with appropriate action, because they don't feel, they feel not good enough. No matter what I do, it won't turn out right, so why act? The next one is my feelings are my reality. And so they determine whether I act, don't act, what I act on, and how I act. I don't feel like it. I do feel like it. I feel upset. I don't feel like I want to write. I feel this, et cetera, as if my feelings are the reality. They're not. They're just my feelings. Another avoidance frictor shows up in language of it's just who I am, which is I use my beliefs, my story, my feelings, my skills, my gender, my assessment results, my age, my experiences, my culture as an excuse to avoid doing it. You know, people in the assessment world go, oh, yeah, well, you know, I don't do that, and I'm not going to, you know, take action because, you know, I'm an introvert, and I don't take action on that. Or I'm a number whatever in my Enneagram, or I'm a I'm a Taurus, or I'm a high D in my disc, and you know, and Tauruses just don't do that. That's who I am. I'm a Taurus. We just don't do that. We don't do that. Or I'm a man, or I'm a woman, or you know, and I'm not good at that. Or I'm too old to do that, or I'm too young to do that, or I don't know enough to do that. All sorts of stuff. Next, avoidance fictor shows up in language that is similar to I'm not in charge, which is abdicating any and all responsibility for taking action. And then the last one is I'm uncertain, and I'm uncomfortable with that uncertainty. And so I don't know what to do, when to act, and where to move. And there's fictor energy in that. I'm uncertain about how it's going to turn out. And most of the time when people are uncertain about how it's going to turn out, is actually they're less in the realm of uncertain about how it's going to turn out than they are filling in the blank that it's not going to turn out well. And then the last set of frictors are the forcing frictors. Forcing comes from two places, ego and fear. And these are some of the ways in which we force. How we force. We force things to start, we force them to stop, to pause, to speed up, slow down, keep going, or stay the same. The places where we focus our forcing energy are on the timing of something. We either try to do it too soon, or we forget, or we try to make it wait till some better time, and we don't attune ourselves to the best time for it. We try to make it too big or too small and to manage it because we may be overwhelmed by it if it's too big. Or if we wanted to make it have some sort of grandiose splash, we try to make it too big. We try to force the quantity of it. This is where you get people who make promises that I'm going to make 20 calls a day to improve my sales. And then they call the next day and they say, yeah, I made 2. What happened? Well, I had a meeting with my boss, and I had this thing with my client, and then I had a coworker situation, and then I had to leave early to see my kid at the soccer game. Oh, now are those excuses? Not necessarily. But they've made an overpromise. We also force the nature of things and the content. We try to force stuff in there that doesn't belong, or force stuff out that does. We try to force the outcome. How is it going to turn out? This is how I'm going to make it happen. And this is an unfortunate one because we have so much of the New Age thing about we can make our lives happen versus we align with it happening. Doesn't mean that aligning is an abdication of taking action. We take action in alignment. And we have become a culture of priding ourselves on overcoming obstacles. But in order to get masterful at that, what do we have to keep creating? More obstacles. We'll force the methodology. Leaders do this all the time. Do it this way. But boss, I have another, I don't want to hear it. Do it this way. And the way that the other person might have creatively come up with might have saved money, saved time, and gotten a better result. But now it's squelched. In the beginning, I used to try and get my son to clean his room in a particular way. I realized I wasn't working with how he worked. Once I did that, he would clean his room. And the other thing, what we try to force personnel, people. We try to force people to be and do things in a particular way, but more importantly, we try to force them to either be in our life or get out of our life. So, Those are the three factors: accountability, forcing, and avoidance. So I want to open up the floor here for a moment and say, what's occurring to you that might be the most seductive of those frictors? And out of those three pages, and I'll back up and just go past them, here's accountability. Here's avoidance. And here's the forcing. Out of those frictors and their little sub-elements, what occurs to you that would be valuable for you to address, subtract the energy of, so that you can move forward naturally on something that's important to you?
Well, the biggest one that impacts me is timing. It's just huge to get things timed in a sequence or an appropriate closeness to do what I'm trying to do in terms of supporting someone.
Right.
And so timing is the one that just drives me crazy, because you can't force it, and you try and be open and flexible with it, but that one drives me crazy.
Okay, great. So what would need to shift in order for you to not have to try and be open and flexible as a technique, but for you to be able to discern the appropriate timing for it?
I don't know, a star in the heavens raising or something? I'm not sure.
Because, you know, the thing is that we'll either try and let it go and not force it, or we'll try and force it. But those are both the same coin. We're trying to control how it turns out. If we can discern and be attuned to the appropriate timing, we don't have to worry about whether or not we are pushing too hard. And sometimes some things need pushing. Or we're giving it enough space. We don't have this second guessing of ourselves. And there's a difference between forcing and adding the appropriate energy.
Can you say more about that, Michael?
Yeah. Okay, so an action. There is a... say there's a person standing in front of you. And you have a couple of pendulums that are swinging down, one from one side, one from the other one, okay? If the person moves too soon, they get hacked by the second pendulum. If they move too late, they get hacked by the first pendulum. If you can discern the appropriate timing, you can give them just enough of a push to have them move and get hacked by neither.
So like dance between the two, so to speak.
Yes.
Have you seen too many Indiana Jones movies, Michael?
Yeah, yes. Yeah, and it's like that. You move too soon, you're going to get clobbered. You move too late, you're going to get clobbered. And it may take some energy in between.
Well, it seems to me then that what's coming to me is this, the answer to that is something to do with presence.
Well, that's interesting. Go a little further with that.
Well, it's just that if you're in the present, then ego and fear don't come into play, and you just sort of the right timing will come to you in the present moment. It can't come to you if there's ego or fear involved.
Yes. That's perfect, and especially in a coaching conversation. Think about it this way. You're in a conversation with a client, and they say something. Now, you can try and move it forward because you think you should. You know, because your ego says, oh, my job is to move it forward, and I have the power to move it forward. Or out of the fear that if I don't move it forward, then that's going to mean something about me as a coach. Or you can add some silence. And then you go, well, the silence is going too long, so I should speak now. Or I'm afraid the silence isn't going long enough, and you can be in there. But in the coaching conversation, in presence, you'll speak when the timing, when it's aligned for you to speak. And it's not just aligned for you, it's aligned for them for you to speak. No? Or is it time to introduce X, Y, or Z concept to them? We all have wonderful wisdom we want to share with people. It's not always time for them to have all of it. So part of the aligning with appropriate action in a pragmatic term is being able to sense out of presence and attune to, while you have this whole range of things you could share in a particular moment, this one isn't it.
Well, it seems there's also an element of this, of the other person or the other people in the room, and they're forcing frictors. So it's, there's a dynamic that's going on. It's not just about us. It's a dynamic of in the room and them trying to force or whatever. And so therefore, you're in the present moment and you're watching them doing forcing frictors.
Yes. And that's where presence, because presence is interconnected sort of with oneness, presence informs how to be with them forcing the frictor. Does that make sense?
That's the discernment piece of it.
Yep. So they may be at the mercy of a frictor that's forcing the moment. And if we're caught in our own stuff and we're not in presence, we won't know how to appropriately align with what is the way to communicate or be with what they're doing. However, in presence, we can. Because we go, oh, I see what's needed. I get it. What's needed is for them to rant for a few minutes. Okay. And because presence in its fullest expression eliminates the illusion of separateness, that is a them and us experience, we're in the spontaneous creation of what the moment is truly calling for.
So it's not about forcing, it's not about anything except being in the present. Your intuition and being in the present will tell you the timing.
Yes.
It will speak to you.
Well, I think that's the struggle, though, is having the heightened.
Yes, and that's why... Right. I spend so much time with subtracting the frictors, because the frictors are the impediments to having that heightened sense of presence.
Mm-hmm.
Think of it like being in a room. If you're in a coaching session and you've got a bunch of frictors present and you're on the phone with a client, think of being in a room with like 15 kids all demanding your attention. In different ways. One wants to be fed. One wants to be washed. One wants to go out. One wants you to hold them. One's crying. One's angry. One wants, you know, all that sort of stuff. That's what it's like to be in the presence of our frictors.
Yeah, and I quickly thought of how I would, one would just leave the room.
Well, yeah. But the unfortunate part is, until we subtract them, the frictors are tied to us by little leashes. So they go where we go. And as Molly just said, if you're in presence, the timing will show itself. If you're absolutely able to be present with your client because everything around you is silent, then the timing becomes obvious. And the action of speaking or not speaking. And if you're in physical presence with them, the timing becomes obvious and the action of speaking, not speaking, even walking over and giving the person a frickin' hug. Becomes obvious. So who else? What frictors tend to, or at least at the obvious place here for you, tend to, and I'll go through these slides quickly again, avoidance frictors, accountability frictors. Forcing frictors. What tends to suck you in?
Well, I think I want to share. I've really been in the doldrums 364 hours. 2 weeks of misery. Pure, unadulterated misery. And then I've just had about 26 hours of understanding recently. So, my frictors are that my passion sometimes gets in the way of my presence. That I want so much for people to understand, and to, if they want to change, I want that so passionately for them. So as I listen to them and I'm present with them, I sometimes have this habit of realizing that they're not getting it. They don't understand, and I want to fix it, but I don't. I know I can't fix it, but in my head I'm saying, they don't get it. You know, how can they be coaches if they don't get their own stuff first? Or if I'm listening in a class, or mm-hmm. or if I'm, you know, with a client, it's not as much with a client because I learned early on that, you know, it doesn't always happen in the session, that light bulb can go on a month, a week, a day, whatever, after. And it might never go on. But when I'm in class and I hear some of these people share who have, you know, coaching practices and they don't get it, I'm saying to myself, they don't get it. But I learned in the last 24 hours, it really doesn't matter. It's not for me to make that judgment or to assess it because I really don't know if they get it or not. So when I can release that and just be who I am, Molly,
mm-hmm.
who wants to coach and help people change where they want to change, that freedom, that space becomes wide open.
Mm.
As it did for me today, my outlook becomes different, and there's no restrictions placed on me. It's a newfound freedom. Everybody moves at their own rate, and I'm not here to push their journey, to move them on their path. I'm here to be whatever they want me to be with them. And that's really it. It's so simple, and I make it freaking difficult. You know, because I make my own life so difficult. And so I really did a lot of thinking today, and I really thought about what was said here tonight about to let go, you know, to really let go of the past as far as trying to change it, because I can't. And when I keep going back to it, it sets me back. And I don't want to be back. I want to be here now. I don't even want to be in the future because I don't know if there is one. But I want right here now, enjoying what is mine to enjoy. And I can't do that if I go back to the past. Because I can't change it. I'm a slow learner.
You mean like some of those people in the class?
No, I don't know about them.
Yes, but you just, what I love what you said in so many levels. And one of the things that I want to highlight out of it is it just also added something to the pointlessness of going to the past. And that is, when we attempt to go to the past and we attempt to change it, some part of us knows that we can't, but we try anyway. And then we try some more, and we still don't change it. We may change our relationship to the past, but we don't change the actual past. Then we also have an experience that is ongoingly compounded of being helpless to do anything. It feeds our sense of helplessness to try and go back and change a past we can't change.
And it's very depressing.
Yes.
And so you live between the forcing and avoidance.
Yes, exactly. Absolutely.
But also, isn't there something to be, in other words, you know, you make a mistake in the past, let's say, but if you keep on repeating that mistake, then there has to be something about that too. So
well,
there's a learning
moment.
Curve.
Yes.
In that past that has to be taken into consideration. It doesn't mean beating yourself up about it because you can't change it, but you sure as heck can learn from it.
Well, you
so
can learn from it.
I always say three strikes and you're out. I don't even go three anymore. It's two and you're done. I don't even give you three anymore because it's not worth it to me. It really isn't.
You're out of here.
Pardon me?
You're out of here.
Yeah, that's right.
It's like
you are. You're done.
The umpire. Yeah, two strikes. You're out.
You're done.
Wait, don't I get a third strike? No, get out.
That's right. I'm too old. I don't have time for three. I only have time for two.
Fun.
I think I'm going to use that, Molly. I'm going to progress to two, and then in a couple more years, I'll progress to one.
Yeah.
Well, one is not always fair. You have to give people the benefit of the doubt. We're not all brilliant like us. I didn't mean that. I didn't say that. I didn't really mean that. Don't. I'm just making a joke, please.
I know. We got it. We got it. So, you know, it's interesting that the past is part of this conversation, because now, you know, and what I'm going to invite you all to do is when you revisit the PDF of this one, revisit the frictors and go to work. Really go to work on them. You know, find them. You know, hunt them down ruthlessly. as Conan the Barbarian would say in the Warrior's Code, crush your enemies. Watch them flee before you and listen to the lamentations of their women. That was his, that was the warrior's code, according to Conan the Barbarian. So, you know, the frictors. But as you're going about addressing them, don't try to force which ones you do because you think it's a good one or you think you have to get them all now. Feel into whether or not it's appropriate to address that one now or later. Sometimes what you're getting is a sense of order from the universe saying, address this one now, wait. Or sometimes it says, address this one, now address that one, and then address that one. Okay, wait, take a break, etc. So pay attention to that. But I want to read to you this whole thing with respect to the past. So weird how things came, because I just came across this article today. But, and you may have seen or read this article, so if you have, just stay with it. There was a nurse who has, she has a blog called Inspiration and Chai, and she's put her observations, she spent a lot of her time counseling the dying in their last days. And she put a book together called The Top Five Regrets of the Dying, as were relayed to her. And she said, you know, when questioned about any regrets they had or anything they would do differently, common themes surfaced again and again. And these were the five that were the top five as she experienced. The first one, and they all had different, they were all in language, you know, meaning something they regretted. First one was, I wish I had the courage to live a life true to myself, not the life others expected of me. And her point was that most people had not honored even half their dreams and had to die knowing that it was due to choices they had made or not made. That was part of their frame of it. Okay? The next one was, I wish I hadn't worked so hard. And she noted that this came from almost every male patient she nursed. They missed their kids' youth. They missed their partner's companionship, etc. The next one was, I wish I had the courage to express my feelings. And what she noted there was a lot of people said they suppressed their feelings in order to keep peace with others. And as a result, they settled for a mediocre existence and never became who they were truly capable of becoming. And a lot of them, people developed illnesses that are related to bitterness and resentment they carried. The fourth one was, I wish I had stayed in touch with my friends. And a lot of them let their friendships go over time because they got caught up in their own lives. They didn't give the friendships the time and effort they deserved. And she said, everyone misses their friends when they're dying. And then the fifth one was, I wish I had let myself be happier. Mm-hmm. And she said, this is a surprisingly common one. A lot of people didn't realize until the end that happiness is a choice, and they'd stayed stuck in old patterns and habits. And they'd stayed in the comfort of familiarity. And fear of change had them pretending to others and to themselves that they were content when deep in, within they wanted to laugh and have silliness in their life again. So, in the article I read, she left the question, what's your greatest regret so far, and what will you set out to achieve or change before you die? And my version of that question is, by putting you in touch with that awareness, is what action, and I'm not asking for an answer right now, but this is a leave this call today question. What action whose call has been there in the background have you not been paying attention to because of the frictors that keep you from acting on it? And so in terms of the work that we do, how to call action as part of evoking it out of people, is that it's a natural consequence of being deeply connected to who we are, our passions, our desires, and the clarity we have about their meaning in our life, both at this moment and for the future. What do we add? What we add to people is the deepest and most powerful connection to being congruent with who we are, who they are, what we're about, and what gives us meaning. And what do we subtract? Any and all fears or concerns about the consequences of taking the naturally obvious actions conjured up, called for, almost demanded by that deep connection. You have the tools for subtraction of the frictors. Here's our little vial again, and this week it's an action potion. And this is what to remember always and in always. The client is privy to an infinity of actions that are in perfect alignment with what they're after. And what that requires is them being an absolute, exquisite connection with who they are, what they're about, and what's meaningful in their life. So, the field work for today is, again, what actions have been being called in the background that you haven't been paying attention to or acting on because some frictor or other or group of frictors is inhibiting your ability to do that, to be so connected to yourself that the action is louder than the frictors that might accompany it. So, out of today, out of all of the things that were presented today and the conversations that we've had, what is being called from you at this moment in time? And I'd like to hear from everyone.
I think that what you just read to us really summed it all up. It's very sad to hear that, but I think we knew it already. I think as coaches, we're more aware of that than most people because we're dealing with it through our personal foundation, through working with clients, our self-assessments, whatever. So even though we might not be taking the action yet, I think that we are, at least I'm aware of it. It was very painful to hear it, extremely painful, because it's very sad for someone to admit that. And as life is ending, it's devastating to me. But there's a way out. And the way out is what we're learning by taking these webinars, by getting as much knowledge as we can, by self-assessing who we are and what we want for ourselves. I think we can change that. I want to change it. I don't want to feel that way. I don't want to end my life thinking like that.
Yes.
And I'm not going to.
Yes.
I'm not going to, because as long as I'm here, I'm going to always try to make it better.
Yes. And that's actually the beauty of coaching, is that in many ways, when we're working in a transformational experience, these five elements, by the way, those five regrets, are the things that we can actually help people transform their lives and subtract off their deathbed conversation. That's what is so almost noble about the profession. That's why it's not about what I've accomplished for me. That's why I gave up the game of how can I help clients accomplish stuff? Because that's it in the grander scheme of these five top regrets. Notice there wasn't any one of them that said, I wish I had accomplished more. They were, I wish I had the courage to live a life true to myself. I wish I hadn't worked so hard. I wish I had the courage to express my feelings, stay in touch with my friends, and let myself be happier. Nowhere in there was, I wish I had built a famous building or had a bridge named after me or written four bestsellers. Another thing that she said in the book was, you know, there was no mention of they wish they wanted to have more sex or have had bungee jumps.
What's the name of the book?
Top Five Regrets of the Dying.
Top Five Regrets of the Dying.
Yes. Her name is Bronnie Ware. She's an Australian nurse. And she cared for patients in the last 12 weeks of their lives.
I did hospice volunteer work for about 3 years, and it really helped me change my life. It was like the impetus from stopping being a lawyer and losing my marriage, and because of this, I was like, I'm not gonna live somebody else's life anymore. And yeah. It was an amazing gift to be with people who are dying.
Yes. So, out of today,
yeah.
What's calling for you in this moment? What's calling to you? What's the action calling?
You know, it's really interesting. I don't have some big calling. It's like, well, the thing that comes to me is just to keep walking down the road that I'm on and taking the next step. And it's more that inner place of, I think it may be that happier and appreciating that next step and not trying to force anything. It's being in a place of allowing rather than forcing. So I'm not trying to force my next action. It's really being open to what's being called for, not forcing it.
Yes, and paying attention to it.
Paying attention.
We can be open to the call, but if we're not paying attention to it. It's like, yeah, I hear my phone ring. I'm not picking it up.
Mm-hmm. And for me, part of it is noticing the energy. I've used that same metaphor that you used about surfing, even though I've never surfed. But it's like, you know, trying to surf when there's no wave action, it's just like, this amazing expensive energy and when the energy comes to go with it.
Yep. Ride the wave.
Yep. And things happen really fast then. So yeah.
Yes.
And I want to meet with my partner Bert. That comes up for me too.
Good. Well, there you go.
So, Bert, you're on notice, if you're still here.
Wow, that's a cosmic blessing right there. So my action is to try and, for as much as possible, to be in the experience of being connected.
Great. And then by means of support, what I would do what I ask is you identify the most seductive calls out of being connected to that experience and subtract them.
Oh, you've given me some homework.
Just seemed to be what was called into the moment. And all I'm doing is asking. You don't have to actually take it on. That's up to you.
Oh, yeah, right.
And how about you, Miss Texas?
Well, I'll be honest, I was just, even while BJ was talking and Bert was talking and reflecting on, like she said, when you mentioned the surfing, I thought of the movie about the surfer, the girl that got bit by the shark and had lost her arm and still went back to surfing. I can't think of the name of it, though, for the love of me.
Mm.
But it was truly the thought that came up when you were even explaining that. And for me, it just means that I really need to, like you said, examine those frictors, remove that, those frictors that are there, and really learn to be more intuitive and be able to do the dance more effectively.
If I can, the intuition I get is that part of the reason of that movie coming up is also indicating that potentially there is a circumstance, or several, a circumstance that looks like it would impede the action that you want to be taking. Do you follow me?
Yeah.
In the movie, in the movie, she doesn't give over to the circumstance. It now becomes the new now for her. That's the new circumstance. So she could fall prey to the circumstance. Well, you know, I've had an arm bitten off by a shark, so I can't. I have to give up surfing. That's the meaning I could assign to the circumstance. Except there was something in her that said no. So she was not at the mercy of the circumstance. She was in attunement with what was calling, an energy that was calling inside her, more important than what the circumstance looked or made look was possible. Beautiful movie. Uncomfortable, but beautiful. Cool. Well, we'll see you all next week, ready to play. We're getting close now.
Thanks, Michael.
Too close. I think we've all decided that you should add an extra class or two.
Well, we're going to do some, listen, we may do some practical stuff just on the, like I said, on the really working these things and working them with each other and then having me help you by course correction as I listen to it, et cetera, so that you can master subtracting the frictors for yourselves. And then if you want to move on to subtracting frictors for other people, we can work on that as well. Okay?
Sounds
cool.
Like.
Yeah, sounds like a plan. See you all next week. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks, Michael.
The moderator has left the conference.